from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
I'm without insurance on the streets of Mexico.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Nick Devlin and Amy Garland Angel? What y'all think? You can hear more from Amy Garland Angel on ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And what do y'all think about our set back here? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion from the proceeds from the sale of these works goes from Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? On tonight's show, our writers show us how one person can have a lasting impact on our life, either while they are here, on their way to the other side, or after they are gone. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Amanda Taylor's grandmother spends her last days with her, showing her what love is. And we'll end the night with Joylynn Humphrey as she realizes that sometimes an impact is not as obvious as we think it is. But let's start the night with Amy Forbus as her father demonstrates his ability to help her hold it all together in Daddy's Not So Little Girl.
I slowly walked back toward the bathroom to check my makeup as my boyfriend John went to put on his suit. I was a freshman in college, and I was back in my hometown for our winter formal, which, for this student on a budget, meant it was a no-brainer to stay at my own house for free instead of going in with a bunch of other students to get a hotel room. John had just finished zipping up my dress for me, albeit with some effort. In another frugal move, I had saved the dress from my senior prom to wear again. After all, I wasn't going to college with any of my high school classmates, so who would care that the dress wasn't new? I learned who would care. The 13 pounds I had gained during my first semester of college would care. I discovered this unwelcome fact a few weeks in advance of winter formal, so I took my dress back to Sadie, the seamstress half the town trusted for both alterations and custom-made gowns. Her verdict? After the alterations we had done to get the dress to fit me in the first place, I had bought it as a half-price special left over from the previous season. There was no extra fabric remaining around the zipper. There was no way to loosen it. I was just going to have to suck it up, literally, and wear what I had. Though it looked like I was spilling over the top of the bodice, it was most certainly too tight for anything to actually fall out, so we figured I would be safe. Winter formal happened to coincide with a significant basketball game at the high school from which my father and I had both graduated. As Daddy headed off to the game that night, John and I began to get ready for the dance. My father expected to come home to an empty house when the game ended, with us kids out partying at the hotel by the lake. Instead, he turned in the driveway to find light streaming through the windows. The trouble had started right after John finished zipping up my dress for me. On my third step back toward the bathroom for that last look in the mirror, my dress suddenly didn't feel so tight. The poor zipper just couldn't take the pressure and had decided that the strapless dress should try being backless too. And so Daddy arrived back home to find me wearing pajamas and my boyfriend, a future mechanical engineer, examining a technical problem. John had the dress splayed out on the kitchen counter, trying to find a way to get the zipper to hold together. I was alternating between trying to help and simply giving up. After Daddy got the story from us and quit laughing, he leaned over the counter next to John, joining in on the troubleshooting. Daddy, who built and remodeled houses during the week and went fishing on the weekends, had always been handy, and soon they had the zipper reassembled. I put on the dress once again and returned to them for the final fastening. This time, the zipper didn't even hold together for 3 steps. A long few minutes of exasperation followed. Some might wonder why a girl's mama wasn't handling this kind of problem. Well, several years earlier, my mother had died, and Daddy and I had become a two-person team. I was the baby of the family, his little girl, the only child still living at home. The two of us rattled around in a 5-bedroom house, each of us with plenty of space to ourselves. With 2 older sisters, a sister-in-law, and an abundance of aunts, I had access to a variety of mother figures. But not one of them was around the night my dress exploded. And besides, what would they have been able to do? Looking at my destroyed dress, I was convinced it was pointless to even try to attend winter formal. But my boyfriend and father continued trying to figure out a way to keep me elegantly clothed for the evening. The evening wore on as the 2 most important men in my life huddled over that dress like a couple of the Queen's own seamstresses. I paced around trying to talk them into giving up. They were undeterred. My frustration grew as they kept seeking a solution to what I saw as an unsolvable problem. At some point, full of hopeless sarcasm, I blurted out, "Well, how about fishing line?" My daddy looked at me, turned around, and made a beeline for the garage. Moments later, Daddy was taking the biggest needle left in my mother's sewing box and threading 6 feet of 20-pound test line through its eye. He doubled it. I guess that would make it 40-pound test. And tied a knot at the end. "John, get dressed," he told my boyfriend. "Y'all are going to this thing." Realizing I wasn't going to get out of this situation, or possibly this dress, I leaned my arm and face against the frame of the bathroom door and let him go to work. John soon reappeared, dressed in a suit and tie, and settled in on the couch to read a collection of Calvin and Hobbes comics. To this day, I thank God that he didn't have a video camera and that YouTube did not yet exist. Taffeta is a resilient fabric. It can possess significant strength, but so can a sewing needle, some fishing line, and a pair of pliers. Daddy would start a stitch by hand and pull it through with the pliers to finish it. He worked his way up the dress in shoelace fashion, pulling up the handle of the zipper every few stitches. In the rare spots where you could see it, the clear fishing line blended right in with the sequins. My brand new monofilament laced corset was a thing of beauty. And it turned out we had no room for error. As Daddy made the last stitch at the top of the zipper, the needle broke in half. I managed to get through the evening without blurting out my secret to everyone I saw, though a select few winter formal attendees did get the story. Most of the photos from that evening are lost to the ages, which is a blessing, as my cleavage that night might best be described as cartoonish. The boyfriend, by the way, who at the end of the evening had the privilege of cutting me out of the dress with his pocket knife, did decide to hang around for the long haul. We've been married for 15 years. He wasn't the hero that weekend, though. When it came to saving the day, it was Daddy, no contest. I guarantee that no other belle at the ball that night managed to get there with quite as much help from her father.
Amy Forbus, an alumna of Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, is the editor of the Arkansas United Methodist, a statewide denominational newspaper. She and her husband, John, live in Little Rock with their 2 dogs. In our next story, Amanda Taylor takes us to her childhood with her grandmother and an unwavering love in Mosquito Bird.
I once saw a mosquito so big I thought it was a bird. Seriously, I was walking up the street in July. It must have been 98 degrees and the humidity was probably around 167%. It might have been higher. In Arkansas, anything is possible when it comes to the humidity. The sun was going down in its lazy, hazy way, but I was still wiping sweat from my hairline. I usually avoid going anywhere without air conditioning in the summer, but today I had to retrieve a cassette tape I had loaned to a friend two blocks over. As you've probably realized, this is not a recent story. I think the tape was a mix I made by holding the tape player up to the radio. The four songs I remember on there were Shoop, Don't Turn Around, Return to Innocence, and Hero. The quality wasn't great, and I'm pretty sure you can hear my sister whining about something in the background, but it was cool. Okay, anyway. As I walked up the street, I was praying that the soles of my shoes wouldn't melt off on the asphalt. I was pretty sure that if my shoes melted, the rest of me wouldn't be far behind. My friends and I had taken to playing the how long can you walk barefoot before you have to jump into the neighbor's front yard game. I swear, one time I saw steam coming out of my little sister Claire, her ears, and the back of her head. Well, she doesn't have a third ear or anything. She was in a sledding accident the winter before. Her sled went out of control on the ice. As her forehead met the bumper of a parked car, it created a splintering crack that could have been easily mistaken for a breaking tree limb. She had a triple skull fracture, but don't worry, the car was fine. Insert drum sting here. I remember that day really well. I ran screaming from house to house looking for someone to help her. The only word I could scream was my sister's name. When I finally found an adult to go check on her, I ran to my house. My mother was in the kitchen in her bathrobe. I remember saying, "Please tell me she's not dead." And looking back, it was probably not the best way to present the situation to her. That night, my sister was rushed to the emergency room. My mother went to the hospital with her, and my dad flew in from Colorado and met her there. And to this day, I'm not sure how they drove on the ice. I think that the police might have taken my mom and the ambulance might have taken my sister. Well, government vehicles don't care about the laws of physics. Because they were at the hospital, I was in charge of staying with my grandmother who lived with us. She was my favorite person in the world, but I was terrified. Well, not of her. I loved her. I was terrified that something would happen, and she would die while my mom was at the hospital. My grandmother had lung cancer. She had been an avid smoker for years, but people like her didn't get cancer. She was mine. So there I was, iced inside the house with the person I loved so much and the monster that was destroying her from the inside. She tried to do things around the house. She had her walker and was convinced that she could make food for herself and me. I was acting strong. I was the head of the house at the moment. But all I could think was, please don't fall, please don't fall, please don't fall. I finally convinced her to let me make TV dinners. After all, as head of the house, I was definitely capable of using the microwave. Well, she did protest. She wanted to cook for me. She wanted to take care of me. She didn't want me to worry. She was so strong. And I often burnt things I cooked in the microwave. When she ate her frozen meal, all I could think was, please don't choke, please don't choke, please don't choke. She didn't. When I brought her the newspaper the next morning, it had some very interesting information about my sister's condition. Apparently she and a few other unlucky sledding enthusiasts would be having brain surgery soon. We didn't have cell phones or the internet back then, so we had to get our information the old-fashioned way, our phone book and our spanking new cordless phone. It turned out that she wasn't going to have brain surgery. She had a concussion, a triple skull fracture, but they would be returning home soon. She was going to be totally fine and didn't have any brain damage at all, just some cracks in her head. My grandmother was elated. When I hung up the phone, I realized that I felt braver than I had the night before. My grandmother and I watched television in her room, and nobody fell or choked. Thank God. After that, my grandmother started to get sicker. She would have seizures, and within a month or two, her hair had completely fallen out. There were times when she would become really confused when she woke up, but she never forgot me or my name. When she would have one of her seizures and was in the hospital, she had periods of delirium. In one of these deliriums, she scared the nurses by trying to get out of the bed with the IVs in her arm. When asked why she was getting up, she would say things like, "I have to pick Amanda and Claire up from school." But she would always come back home to our house. Her room was the first, one I went to when I woke up, and when I got back from school. She would say, "Amanda, come here to me." She had said that to me all of my life. It had reached the point of switching from a request to another form of I love you. After a while, she lost the power to speak. When I ran into her room, she would reach her arms out and strain to sit up. Her skin was yellow, and now there were all sorts of beeps and whirs in the room, and she wouldn't have her turban on, and she had no hair at all. She had lost so much weight from her once soft and cuddly body that the loose skin looked like strange wings on her arms. It scared me. I didn't recognize her when she was that weak. She was so weak, and all she wanted to do was hold me. I often think to myself how glad I am that I went to her. When I was hugging her, she was my grandmother again. She smelled the same. Even though she couldn't speak, she was still able to tell me she loved me. She died that spring in the middle of the night. My mom was by her side, and my grandmother knew it. She says my grandmother looked straight at her in a moment of lucidity. My mother promised she would take care of me and my sister. My mom said she looked peaceful when she told her that. I was asleep on the pull-out couch in our living room when she drew her last breath. Nanny was my grandmother, and she loved me, my mom, and my sister more than anything in the world. We were her world, and she was ours. I'm sorry. I got distracted. I was talking about the mosquito bird.
Amanda Taylor is currently a therapist for children and adolescents. She has the best family and friends a person could ask for. She hopes that this story will share a message about the wonderful impact of love. In our final story of the night, Joylynn Humphrey's trip to say goodbye to her brother helps her fill in the empty spaces in Visitation.
I almost missed the driveway because I am looking for, expecting something much bigger and more formal. Instead, I turn into a small parking lot of what once had been a smallish church. How are all the cars going to fit, I wonder? There is no landscaping to speak of, the most noticeable characteristic being the rusty brown stains marring the gray roof that seriously clashes with the tan brick exterior. Somehow, I park and exit the car, and I find myself bending to help my mother from her car, where she has been sitting, looking at the church come funeral home, unable to bring herself to go in. I assume it is because of the task ahead. As I take her arm, I ask if she's okay. "Oh my God, would you look at this place," she says. I wish she had used Kilpatrick's. Kilpatrick's is the funeral home and the standard by which all other funeral homes in my hometown are judged. Mama had worked for Kilpatrick's as a young woman, as a secretary. She had also assisted with hair and makeup on the customers when needed. This funeral home we were about to enter is not a place that anyone in our family had ever used. I wrap my arm in hers and together retrudge toward the place through the stifling afternoon heat. We walk past the ever-present cigarette butt receptacle in pride of place by the main entrance, open the doors, and find ourselves in a foyer. A woman who is dressed like it is still 1979 emerges from a side door. "Are you family?" "Yes," I reply. "I'm his sister, and this," gesturing toward mother, "this is his mother." And in that statement, we have established our credibility, our right to be here early, before the others are expected, our right to be comforted, our right to grieve. "I'm sorry for your loss," she says genuinely. She ushers us through double doors into what was once the church sanctuary, still boasting the sturdy pews of a real church, not those soft, cushiony chairs that can be moved around to fit the needs of the present-day churchgoer. And I find myself standing in a worn-out, tumble-down, seen-better-days, hotter-than-hell room. Some of the big, square ceiling tiles show water and age stains. Several sag miserably. One sits askance in its hole. The air has a fusty smell. Likely the air conditioner has been turned up for a few days to save on the astronomical electricity bills that are a certainty in a southern summer. And then reality hits me like a case of the flu. I am 20 feet away from his body. I was there at the hospital when he died. I saw the flat line on the heart monitor. I saw him after they respectfully asked us to leave and removed the ventilator and cleaned him up and made him presentable for us to see again. He was my brother then. But this is different. It's been a week. He's been worked on. The body bears little resemblance to the person he was. The casket's unable to contain the larger-than-life life he lived. The abject stillness of the corpse, the refusal of the face to crack his signature smile, the motionless hands, his big, beautiful hands, lying useless and idle, all underscore the sense of finality. Mama and I approach him. It is the longest 20 feet I have ever walked. I glance at him quickly, but immediately turn to support my mother. I watch my mother's reaction, her face, as she looks upon the dead body of her second child, the younger son, the middle one. She grips my hand and breaks. "They did a good job on him," she whispers. "They did a real good job on him." And I stupidly agree. I mean, what can I say? He looks a hell of a lot better than he did when he was in the hospital, on the ventilator, gasping and grimacing toward death. And then later, after his heart stopped, when he began to turn blue, but it was really more like purple, his flesh turned cold. Yes, he does look better than he did then. I get Mama to the front pew and sit her down. She sags and drops her head, and the grief around her is palpable. And the next few hours contain countless repetitions of this same reaction. And then I'm talking. Talking to the blue eyes, the gray, brown, green, hazel, blue, cloudy, glazed, pained, red, and puffy. Talking to women, wives, daughters, mothers, sisters, friends, and cousins. Women who had loved and left or lost him, married and divorced him, made love to him, bore him children. Some who didn't want him when he lived, but wouldn't wish death on him now. The redhead, the blonde, the brunette, the raven-haired, each so completely different, yet sharing this one man. Briefly talking to children, not acting like children, they've had the talk. Or independently come to the realization that this is not a place to play. It's not the time for that. Talking to man after man, young and old, related and not, covered with the day's work, or showered and freshly shaved, wearing too much cologne. Men who knew him but never met me. "I didn't know he had a sister." "Oh, honey, I didn't mean that." Men who at one time were objects of my desire or I of them, not realized or awkward in the knowledge of that prior intimacy. Mid-sentence, a childhood crush reaches out, brushes a strand of hair from my face, stopping me cold, dead in my tracks. For a second, there's a glimmer of something other than the hollowness that had been there. The door flags constantly with a steady stream of men and women coming to pay their respects. Oppressive Louisiana heat shimmering from the asphalt parking lot, pouring in, the cool pouring out. It is impossible to cool this room. Wet patches under our arms, our shirts stuck to our backs, a fine sheen atop a lip. Standing, nodding, smiling, laughing, hugging, patting, crying, and sobbing, looking over a shoulder to catch a glimpse of Mama. "How's your mama doing? Is Mama okay? Somebody check on Mama, please." Stale breath in my face, or artificially minty, or yeasty from beers drunk to dull the pain or construct determination to make this visit. Others acrid with nicotine and coffee. Some sour with age or their own illnesses. Drinking cheap, weak coffee from a tiny styrofoam cup doctored with sugar and powdered creamer. "This powdered stuff will kill you, you know." "No, sweetie, death will kill you. Pouring it down the sink, wishing for a cigarette, a joint, a pill, a drink. Laughter rings out here and there. The first time I laugh out loud, I catch myself think, is that appropriate? How can I be laughing? The essential need for laughter dawning on me, that the living remember and laugh over tales of the departed, our shared hijinks, mundane things, because that is how we are. It is what people do. As the talking subsides and people drift out, as the sun shifts lower in the sky, as the thermometer hovers at the sweltering mark and the day comes to a close, my sense of this building and this place has shifted. Initially, I thought it wasn't good enough. It wasn't nice enough. My initial response was based on a superficial assessment of the facade, based on my values, my biases. In reality, the place is perfectly appropriate. It is not stiff, formal, or imposing. It does not overshadow the person. My trite estimation of the place is similar to the kind of evaluation of the man that some may make. This man who married, had children, divorced, remarried, had more children, and repeated the cycle several more times. This man who didn't hold a job most of the time, who drank too much, who smoked too much, who talked too loud, who wore his hair too long, who didn't take anything too seriously. Seeing the number of friends, the depth of their caring, the extent of his influence on others, I realized that many of the usual goalposts of judging a life don't apply in this situation. The man was bigger than his habits or shortcomings or eccentricities. He had touched so many people in a very real and positive way. His humor, his energy, his love of his family and friends transcended his lack of direction or the size of his bank account or the number of years at a job. To the last person, he will be sorely missed. The initial power that the corpse held over me had loosened at some point during the afternoon. Now, holding his spirit firmly in my heart, I turn to walk out of this place, back into the heat.
Joy Lynn Bernice Humphrey, originally from Louisiana, has lived in Arkansas for 20 years. She is married to a praiseworthy man, and they have two exceptional children. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What'd y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website, and we are open for submissions from Southerners. For more information, visit talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.